and welcome to the latest edition of Seattle Nice. I'm David Hyde, a politics reporter here in Seattle, joined as always by the editor and publisher of Publicola, Erica C. Barnett, and political consultant Sandeep Kaushik. Today we actually have a special guest, the first guest we've ever had on Seattle Nice. But first, a word from this week's first local sponsor.
Hi, are you thinking about running for office? I'm local political fundraising consultant Gabe Magic. I help everyday people like you raise money to reach voters and get elected in city, county, and state races. I prioritize candidates working towards racial, economic, and environmental justice. I'll coach you through the discomforts of asking for money and tailor our strategies to best fit your skills. Together, we'll have fun and celebrate meeting financial goals. Reach out today to talk more about funding your winning campaign.
That's Gabe Magic with Magic Consulting. Some of his past clients include ranked choice voting for Seattle Proposition 1B and State Senator Claudia Kaufman, Representatives Mary Foss and Kristen Harris-Talley, and De-escalate Washington's Initiative 940. If you want to get in touch with Gabe Magic and Magic Consulting, wherever you get your Seattle Nice podcast, just go to our show notes and you'll find a link there where you can get in touch with Gabe. And what I love about this is that Gabe came to us saying, you know, I think you have an audience that I would really benefit from reaching. If you put yourself in that same category, let us know that you're interested in advertising at RealSeattleNice at Twitter. So today, we're going to be talking about a Walgreens pharmacy at 566 Denny Way. At one time, this building was the Seattle First National Bank building. So it's something that historic preservationists are interested in, and it became a subject for the Seattle City Council this week. And joining us to just talk about the issue of historic preservation, not only for that building, but kind of more generally an advocate for historic preservation, Chris Moore. He's the executive director of the Washington Trust for Historic Preservation. And Chris, before we get into what the council did, we'll go to Erica for that. But I want to start with you just by asking, why the hell would anybody want to preserve a drive-through pharmacy? Chris, aren't there enough pharmacies in Seattle?
You know, there probably are enough pharmacies in Seattle, but the designation and preservation of buildings isn't necessarily tied to use. So people look at it and say, oh, yeah, this is a pharmacy and it's a drive-through and we don't need more of those. But the use isn't what the designation controls, so to speak. It's the building. It's the architecture. It's the sense of history that's provided. It's the record of history in our built environment that's provided from that as well. So quite honestly, the use in this case is incidental. There's probably, I'm sure there's a lot of better uses for that space or ones that the community might want to see in terms of how that building itself is used. The designation is not to save a Walgreens. It's the architecture and it's the building.
One of Erica's followers on Twitter says, mid-century does not meet a historical bar. Tell us a little bit about why this thing is considered a historic building. What's a little bit about the history of it? Don't go too deep if you don't mind.
And then,
we'll move on. But like, you know, mid-century doesn't meet a historical bar. In this case, somebody thought it did, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'll try not to get too wonky with it, but the national standard, the federal standard for when something can be considered historic is 50 years, a 50-year cutoff. So like it or not, I'll be honest, I'm a little, the last couple of years, I'm a little less comfortable with that 50-year mark being considered historic. But from an architectural standpoint, that is what we look at. So if you go back, what are we, 2023? Something built in 1973 then, technically, if I'm doing my math right, could be considered a historic landmark from the federal standards. Seattle's even a little bit more unique. Their threshold's 25 years. So it cuts it even a little bit shorter. And that was, as I understand it, in part because of the Space Needle. So you may not like the style. It may not be a style that resonates with you. But from a ordinance standpoint, a legislative standpoint, the years are a specific cutoff. Mid-century modern, whether you like it or not, is a prominent architectural style. So there's good examples of mid-century modernism. There's bad examples of mid-century modernism as well, just like with any style.
What about this building? Last question for you here for a minute.
Yeah, no, I think this building is a good example of mid-century modern. The architect himself, J. Lister Holmes, it's interesting because it shows the trajectory of his work to some degree. He came out of the Beaux-Arts tradition and then ended up working in a mid-century idiom. This was later on in his work, a little bit later, but he it's interesting to look at some of the other work that he's done that isn't around anymore, and I think that's something that's important as well. He did the Yesler Terrace housing, which now, of course, is gone, and there's new housing up there, and rightfully so. But it's part of an overall record of a body of work as well. So from that standpoint, I certainly believe it warrants landmark status.
All right, before we get to the exciting debate part of the show, Erica, so what did the council decide to do with this drive-through Walgreens?
The landmark status has been in place since 2006. So what this was protections and controls. So basically saying, you know, it is impermissible to alter anything about the exterior of this building. Of course, the interior has been totally altered. It's a Walgreens now, without getting the permission of the Landmarks Board. So if anything changes, if a future owner or if the current owner wants to do anything with the exterior of the building itself, the Landmarks Board has to say yes. So what that means is, you know, it's going to be harder to demolish it for potential future housing. This is in, you know, of course, one of the densest areas of the city. And even just small changes to the exterior, we'll have to get permission from the Landmarks Board. To finish the answer to that question, they were going to landmark the drive-through itself, the driveway and the awning and, you know, the overhang, and also a pillar that used to be a sign, and they decided not to do that. So that was kind of the quote-unquote compromise, is not landmarking the driveway and then not landmarking the sign or the parking lot, which were also all in the original the proposal to protect that whole area. So there's a little bit of the land, about half, that can potentially be developed in the future, but the Walgreens building, the Seafirst building, is totally protected now.
It sounds like we're returning to Sandeep's vision of an ideal Seattle, where everybody kind of comes to some agreement somewhere about things. But Sandeep, I just want to like go straight to a question. Council member Tammy Morales, in thinking about this issue, said basically preserving this building doesn't make sense given the housing crisis that we're in. And I'm wondering what you make of that argument.
I make a lot of that argument. I think Tammy's right. I'm not often in agreement with Tammy Morales on a lot of different stuff, but on this one, I think she's absolutely right about it. In fact, I don't know where to begin about the Landmarks Board. But I will say this. I'll start with an anecdote. I had one experience with the Landmarks Board a few years ago. I was when I was still on the board of Schools First, which is the volunteer group that comes together to pass the school levies every 3 years. I heard that the Landmark Board was taking up an effort to landmark the building, the old Wilson Pacific Middle School at 90th and Wallingford. And this is a dilapidated middle school building that was slated to be completely rebuilt and replaced with fresh money from the school levy, you know, from the Bex levy. And the only thing of note about the building was that there was a Native American mural outside, or a couple of murals that the school district had already committed to preserving. But somebody asked for landmark status because, you know, it's some 1960s era style of shitty school buildings that got built back then. And so it went before the Landmarks Board. I went and testified because my kids were going to go to this middle school. And guess what? I wanted them to go to a nice middle school and not a shitty, dilapidated middle school. Like, right? And I sort of testified to that effect. And the experience was totally like, it was a board of kind of whack job like activists who basically landmark every fucking thing that comes before them, right? Like they're, so I don't understand why I shouldn't think of these people as a bunch of, you know, kind of crackpot zealots and activists who are, you know, living in some delusional fantasy where they're Jane Jacobs saving Grand Central Terminal, while, you know, what they're actually doing is stopping our ability to move forward on, you know, important developments in the city and addressing some of the core problems we face, like housing affordability. or you know, the lack of housing stock or whatever.
Can I jump in and be the voice of moderation here?
Please do.
I can't believe I'm saying this.
Taking it back, since Sandeep actually took it back to that same question, but, you know, yeah, respond to Sandeep if you can, Erica, but also, you know, preserving this building doesn't make sense given the housing crisis that we're in, if you can kind of take it back there as well.
Well, I mean, absolutely. You know, this is in one of the densest areas. I will say, I mean, as the reporter who's been writing about this probably the most, I mean, it is not proposed to be housing yet. I think that is obviously the highest and best use of this space and what it would become eventually, and probably, you know, and maybe will, regardless of the landmark status. I think, you know, one of the things that I found most interesting in my reporting, and the thing that actually got me kind of obsessed with this story, was not like, I hate this building. I think it's a charming little building, you know, despite being kind of a stripped out Walgreens, you know, inside. But there are so many copies of this building. You know, as Chris mentioned, I mean, the original architect was J. Lester Holmes, but he made a prototype. And actually, the original building on that prototype is in Soto. It was built 5 years before this. And I was able to go around the state and kind of look up all these buildings that are still standing. I think two of them have been torn down, but I found 11 copies around the state, 9 still standing, of this exact same building. And so, you know, it was meant to be sort of a model for a chain along the lines of, you know, I would say a McDonald's or, you know, or something along those lines, a drive-through bank that was going to be replicated everywhere. And this is one of those replicas. And so I think if we're going to argue like for, oh, my God, we need to save this, you know, this great, you know, work of architecture by this architect, or a so-so work of architecture by this architect, then we should be arguing, frankly, to save the one in Soto and let the rest of them come down. Because, you know, I mean, not that all the ones everywhere else are at risk, but this is the one where I think there is the least argument to save it. It's been stripped out inside. It has none of the interior details. And it's in the middle of a city that's in the middle of a housing crisis and in the middle of a neighborhood that's developing into housing for tech workers who are causing the housing crisis.
All right, Chris, let's have you respond to that. And I guess there's two different versions of it. Wackos wanting to preserve this don't make sense given the housing crisis we're in, or just preserving this doesn't make
wacko
sense given
activists.
The housing crisis that we're in.
Wacko activists, the delusions that they're Jane Jacobs. Please.
All right, so Chris, that's it. Yeah, that's the question.
Yeah, I'm going to start with Erica just because I'm not even sure what to do with you, Sandy. But I think, even with the McDonald's, right, Is it worthy of preserving one of them, given the cultural impact McDonald's has had, whether you like it or not? And so I think it's a good point, Erica. I don't know if the others that you have found that are still standing, I don't know if they're landmarked or not. And my guess is they probably are not. So, you know, I would say having an example that does, again, help provide that record is important. Was this the best one to have? I don't know if it was or not, but this is the one that did come through. Why this one came through, I don't recall back to 2006 why indeed this nomination came before the Landmarks Board, because it was designated in 2006. It may have been because of the community at the time. Folks wanted it. It might have been based on some survey that had happened looking at mid-century architecture worthy of preserving. So I agree. We don't need to necessarily save every single one if there are multiple copies of something, but having one that can be preserved is important. Sandeep, you know, I think probably there's everybody that's had an experience with some board or commission like that, where they don't like the way it went. They don't like what happened. They don't like the outcome. And so it's real easy to say, oh, they're a bunch of whack jobs, but you know, they're not. This is
turn down a landmarks designation?
Sure.
There are
landmarks. Absolutely. There are nominations that are turned down. And in fact,
I wrote about one recently, by the way.
Yeah. And in fact, there are, you know, the staff reviews things first. So typically, and I don't want to say 100% here, but typically I think if a nomination is getting in front of the board anyway, it's already been vetted by the preservation staff, and they've already determined that, yeah, there's something here that at least we want the board to look at. And on those same levies, you know, if it weren't for those levies in that review, I don't know what you would argue about Franklin, Garfield, or Roosevelt High School, or West Seattle High School, for that matter. Each one of those would be gone if it weren't for the preservation review of them, because those were in earlier school levies. And I think there's a lot of people who look at those and say, yeah, there's great, you know, they've been adapted for great use with great additions to them that bring them up to modern standards and modern use. So
sure.
The board's there for that purpose.
I do not deny that there are buildings worthy of historical preservation in the city of Seattle. What I'm saying is that the process has gone way off the fucking rails, like, and way too much stuff. That the justification, just in that case, the justification really galled me for granting landmark status to this building. It was because 20 years, something like 20 years previously, for a couple of years, there had been a Native American, Seattle schools program that had been housed in that building. It had left no, you know, external marks except for these murals that were already going to be preserved as part of the new building. But, the program had long since decamped to Rainier Beach, and, you know, and really that's where people recognize it as its home. But nevertheless, for that one reason, because sometime in the past, for a couple of years, there'd been this program here in this building, we're going to landmark it. Now, it ended up that the building got rebuilt anyway, right? I mean, I think it just took longer and cost more money, right? And there is a new Eagle Staff Middle School, right, at 90th and Wallingford that one of my kids ended up going to. So I don't know what all that did except like delay and increase, you know, the amount of money that got spent to do that. And the other example I'll bring up from the past, Erica, you remember this. Remember this might have even been back when you were living in Ballard, but remember the Denny's in Ballard that became the sort of car?
The Googie, yeah. Denny's. The Googie architecture.
I mean, I was partial to that Denny's because it was the only thing you could do at night.
Yeah.
The only place hours. To get affordable food, right, in Ballard.
I remember.
I like Denny's. I'm pro Denny's. I'm just not pro, like, preserving the Denny's building.
That was, it's Canute Berger wrote about that and came on KOW to talk about it and was talking all about the Googie architecture and stuff like that. But in his story, all the old Ballardites were pissed off because there was no more Denny's there.
Yeah.
There's a fundamental disagreement here, though. Isn't there a kind of tension on this show between people who are skeptical of progress and people who are kind of blindly in favor of all forms of change based on the idea that that's necessarily progress? And what about Chris's like skepticism? Like, is Ballard really that much better? Yes, we got those apartments, but, you know, is all this change so wonderful? Like, you know, that, I mean, I think that's the fundamental question here. Sandeep, a sort of Pollyannish supporter for all change and progress, he would obviously like to bulldoze that fucking Space Needle and put right. a nice new like skyscraper in there or whatever. I mean, you're kind of on that side of things, right?
Yes. I want to turn everything into a wine bar.
I mean, David, like, I know you're being tongue-in-cheek, but I mean, I do think Ballard is so much better than when I lived there 20 plus years ago. That doesn't mean that, like, all progress, quote-unquote, is good and we should bulldoze right. everything. But in this city, I mean, it is, as you know, as Chris noted, like, 25 years is all it takes to start, you know, the conversation around landmarking. That's 1998, you guys. I mean, I would defy all of you to find a building in 1998 that needs to be preserved, but I bet the Landmarks Board could do it. You know, I think a lot of this, you know, Sandeep said this is the Landmarks Board wanting to be Jane Jacobs. And, you know, we just don't have a whole lot of stuff in Seattle that is worth preserving a la Jane Jacobs, because we are a very young city.
Ooh,
and so often
that's a great point. That's interesting.
So, So often what ends up happening is we cling to these things like, you know, like identical craftsman cottages. And we say this is a historic district and nothing can be built here in Wallingford. When frankly, I mean, this stuff was cookie cutter at the time. And if we look more recently, there is, as Sandeep said, a lot of shitty stuff that got built in the 60s and 70s and shoddy construction. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, the 1990s were not a great time for, you know, wonderful historic buildings either. But I can see a future in which, you know, the Landmarks Board is saying we need to preserve this late century architecture because, you know, because it's old for Seattle.
This and, happened and frankly, in this
and
actually.
It's only old in Seattle. It's not old anywhere else. It's not this, old in San Francisco. I mean, it's
same it's, same it's argument fake. Happened. I think in 1700 in Boston, the King's Chapel burying ground. People were like, "What the fuck? Dig up the old bones. Let's we can put some condos here. It's only 70 years old. It's only 50 years old. I mean, it doesn't you know don't sure. old thing newish things eventually become old? Isn't that how it works? I mean, you know, how do you know what future generations are going to value?
I mean, that's part
well,
of.
Well, I can tell you that the stuff being built in the 1990s is going to be falling down by then.
Well,
so
that's there is that, which is actually I think an argument for preserving more. To be quite honest, but I should Seattle be punished because it's a younger city than other cities? I mean, does that mean that our stuff isn't as good as say New York or Boston or wherever simply because we're a younger city? And there is quite a bit of even if you look East Coast, yes, there's some houses and other buildings that might be in that you know early 19th century, but still a lot of what's out there that people are drawn to and like to preserve is that kind of early 20th century, late 19th century, which Seattle does, you know, that's Pioneer Square. And so there is, I don't think we should be punished because we are a younger city, so to speak, than others.
Well, no, but is New York preserving stuff from the 1980s and the 1970s?
I mean, for sure.
I think you can't also just say that, well, it's, you know, it's old for us and therefore it needs to be preserved. No, I'm not saying but I think that argument is going to come up more and more because, yeah. You know, it's.
But remember, it's not age alone, right? It's not age alone. And I was just thinking when you were talking about, you know, something in the 90s, when was the new Seattle Central Library built? Was that the Rem Koolhaas building, right? Was that around late 90s?
That was 2000.
Early 2000s because it was there before I moved to Seattle, and I got here in 2005. So hey, that might be the first 25 year mark, Erica, of looking and getting to this Seattle Central Library. Yeah. But it's not just age, right? Like one of the things that matters from a Seattle landmark standpoint is that integrity, and that's before you can apply any of those criteria of significance. The building's got to meet a certain integrity threshold, which means is it still have the ability to essentially convey its significance? Does it have enough original historic fabric? And Sandeep, you talked about that shitty mid-century school that was dilapidated. You know, we kind of talk about that a lot. Condition is different than integrity, right? Like something can be in bad shape, but it might still have a high level of integrity. And the bad shape is because it hasn't been maintained. So sometimes we're in this position of buildings being talked about as tossaways, not because they're bad buildings, but because they haven't been maintained. Now that goes to a deeper issue of how we allocate resources and how we treat the things we've already built. But Erica, I do agree. We're going to see, I think a lot of these housing and commercial, single family houses for sure, and probably residential multifamilies that were built in the 90s, you know, they ain't going to last the 50 years that we look at for landmark status.
Well, not just that, but I mean, when you talk about single family houses and you talk about a lot of these landmark proposals, I mean, you know, yes, integrity is a standard, but that doesn't mean that the Landmarks Board, you know, is always perfectly apolitical either, right? I mean, a lot of times what happens, and certainly not the city council, and a lot of times what happens is people have an agenda of preventing development in single family areas or preventing development in Seattle, period, and use the landmarks, you know, the landmarks process and the protections process as a cudgel. And we can't just sort of pretend that, you know, it's all about people in ivory towers, you know, kind of dispassionately deciding whether a building has integrity and whether it's, you know, meets however many of the six criteria, because frankly, I mean, I've looked at a lot of landmark applications over the years and they always argue that it meets, you know, three or four of the six criteria. No matter what the building seems to be and no matter how many examples of it there are in Seattle. And I am thinking mostly of single family houses. And that is a development prevention strategy that is tried and true and tested in Seattle.
Do we know, like, sort of, is there a way to quantify, like, how much do you think landmark status is the reason why we don't have enough affordable housing in Seattle? Like, you know, I remember a few years ago, there was some discussion about that surrounding, like, Airbnbs, and I went and looked at it, and it was like, what did they say? It was like 0.5% of all available potential rentals were Airbnbs. It was some pretty teeny amount. And so what is it with landmarking? I mean, is this just more like a symbolic thing that's getting in the way of affordable housing in a city that's just got a lot of single family housing, and that's our real problem? Or is it really a serious obstacle?
Well, I mean, the main obstacle is zoning, but and landmarking, certainly. I mean, you could say, oh, it's only prevented, you know, whatever, pick a random number of units of housing, 500, 1,000, which isn't very much, right? But I mean, that's not an argument to say that we should just let the Landmarks Board and the city council and this kind of preservationist anti-development instinct run roughshod over the city. I mean, yeah, we need to change zoning much more than we need to change the landmark process if we're just looking at number of housing units we could build. But I mean, they're kind of one and the same thing. I mean, it's the same people arguing right. that we should preserve our sacrosanct, you know, single family zoning that are arguing that we should preserve our sacrosanct single family houses.
I would say it's not some kind of magic wand panacea that, you know, just get rid of the dumb parts of landmarking and everything's going to be fine. But it's also more than symbolic. I mean, when I look at the landscape the challenges to kind of building housing in the city of Seattle, it seems like there's a number of different kind of potentially unnecessary impediments and roadblocks that sort of taken together, whether it's zoning or landmarking or, you know, another board that's come under a lot of criticism recently is design review, right? So, where, you know, every building has to go before this other panel of, like, you know, aesthetes and architects who basically, as far as I can tell, you know, often just blandify, you know, buildings in Seattle, but it's a cumbersome, time-consuming process that raises the cost of building housing. And I think there are legitimate questions about, given our need to grow and add more housing, should we be either eliminating or reducing some of these roadblocks?
Yeah. And there, you know, there are just over 400 landmarks in Seattle. So this argument that preservation or landmarks is halting development or affordable housing, I just don't think is accurate. You know, 400 is relatively speaking to the number of structures in the city is rather negligible. I don't think the preservation board is anti-development. I think they're looking at the preservation value of buildings. Now that designation can lead certainly to a reduction of what can be developed there, but there are some incentives in place. And I know, Erica, you've written about these with regard to the Walgreens, the C-First Bank, and those are the TDRs. So are there ways with transfer development rights to actually get that density or get that FAR back on another site, on another receiving site that can use essentially those restricted components? One other thing I was going to say back to you, Sandeep, which I've now lost because I focused on the other two, but it'll come to me.
Yeah. Well, and Chris, it's one thing when you, and I'm using you as the sort of as the proxy for the larger sort of preservationist community, come and say, you know, oh my God, we've got to save Pike Place Market. These, you know, crazy city fathers want to, like, tear down this, you know, asset to the community. I'm incredibly sympathetic to that. Or, you know, we got to stop them from building a frickin' highway through the Arboretum, you know, and preserve this amenity. You know, I think there's immense sympathy for that kind of preservation, where I think we all understand the benefit. Where it gets really controversial, and I think you lose me, is when I see some pretty pedestrian. I mean, the other example I can bring up is back when they were going to rebuild the, you know, when the monorail project was going to go forward and get funded. Remember, there was a whole thing about the brutalist architecture of the concrete pylons that were holding up the old monorail, yeah. And that was going to be this huge impediment to us building a fucking transportation system, because these hideous concrete pylons were some great architectural masterpiece of whatever. And that's where I'm just kind of like, fuck off.
do you want to know that the viaduct, I believe, don't quote me on this, even though I'm being recorded, I think the viaduct was determined eligible for listing in the National Register. Now, was anyone arguing to save the viaduct? No.
Yes.
Well, okay.
Frank Chop was, but not from
a preservation standpoint, Erica. I think this is where some of it gets weaponized, right? This is where preservation can get weaponized, like anything can. Environmentalism can, housing can get, anything can get weaponized from that degree. So maybe there were some saying, yes, the viaduct is such a historic resource, we need to save it for its historic significance. We certainly weren't.
There was a gas station on Capitol Hill that people were arguing needed to be saved from housing on 15th very recently. I mean, there are countless examples of this that we can just kind of like pull, from our memory of recent arguments over preservation, where it does get weaponized, and it gets weaponized for this one specific purpose of preventing housing. And so I think that, I think the Walgreens is also a really good example of that. I think historic Seattle in particular, has a lot of power in this city. And their purpose, to preserve historic buildings, but often it's, preserving buildings in places. I mean, the one that I was talking about earlier that didn't end up getting landmarked was this incredibly unremarkable building on Capitol Hill, known as the Jai Tai Building, that was going to, potentially prevent an affordable housing tower from being built there. So, there's just like example after example that are in these dense areas of buildings that are not, particularly significant or significant work of a major architect or whatever, but they're used to try to prevent housing.
But
so,
that one did not.
Hence my skepticism about the board and the process. And did not.
Sandeep, I now remember that's what a I rare was example. Say to your yeah. point about design review boards. I'm not sure if either of you are following this, but this is being addressed by the legislature right now. House Bill 1026 would look to remove all design review boards for any housing project. And we're actually trying to find out, get clarity, concern, because does that include local historical commissions? Is that defined as a design review board or not? So would Seattle Landmarks Board be a local design review board in the context of this bill? We're trying to still figure that out, but it would do exactly what you're saying. And this has been, this has been an issue for, and this isn't a historic thing. These are newly constructed buildings, anywhere they might be, where a design review board has purview. And of course, they're outlier. Coming back to Queen Anne, people talk about the Safeway building, right? That was there and took 7 years to get through design review or whatever it was. And that's not okay. Obviously, it shouldn't take that long. And I think that's an outlier, but you're right. This is getting traction at the state level right now for sure.
I think, Chris, you're putting your finger on that. I mean, there does seem to be, first of all, there's a kind of, I think when you look at the broader political trends in the city of Seattle, and maybe this is true in Olympia and statewide as well, but there does seem to be a kind of urbanist turn to a lot of thinking. And there's a momentum behind kind of urbanist approaches, right? Which I think, generally has a stance of some skepticism towards some of the kind of this older model of, the kind of Jane Jacobsy model of focusing on preservation. And so I think I wasn't aware of the Olympia bill, but it doesn't surprise me that it's out there. I think I will say, and Erica, I'm curious about your thoughts about this. I was surprised the city council ended up taking the stance it did, which had basically overrode the unanimous vote of the committee to impose this quote unquote compromise that basically did back up the Landmarks Board on at least preserving the building structure itself, if not the parking lot. And I was kind of surprised that they went there.
I mean, I was surprised when the committee voted the way it did, and I was not surprised that there was a flip-flop that happened. I think there is a tendency, and always has been on the council, you know, maybe less so over time, to kind of be cowed by the voices of, you know, historic preservation, who say that once we tear down, you know, whatever, you know, the Denny's or the Walgreens or the Seafirst Bank, we'll never have it again. And so it is, you know, kind of the conservative point of view, you know, in a small C sense, to say, well, we might as well just let's preserve it and then maybe we can revisit it later on. You know, I think, I just think that in a city where, you know, we have a, you know, very visible homelessness crisis, when we have, you know, more and more people moving here than, units of housing being built, I just think these things have to be balanced. And, you know, and I would say to Chris's point about design review boards, I mean, I would not call the Safeway example an outlier, where they prevented housing for 7 years. I made it a lot more expensive. I mean, I covered this much smaller building on Finney that, you know, eventually did get built. But the design review board was very, very receptive to and reacted to, you know, favorably to comments like, you know, the people in this building will be having parties on the roof and it's going to disrupt the neighborhood and all this stuff that, like, really didn't have anything to do with design review. There was concern trolling about the fact that they wouldn't have air conditioning or individual washers and dryers in their units in this apartment building, and saying, you know, it would lead to, you know, laundry outside and all this stuff that, like, you know, I mean, it's not about design. And I feel like in a similar way, landmarking is often not really about landmarking.
Once something is demolished, it is gone. And I think we overlook that sometimes. It's so – I do it myself with a building that I have, you know, maybe gone by and liked, and then it's demolished because it's part of a new development. And like the next week, you forget it's there. So, you know, there's something to that. We shouldn't make light of the fact that once something is demolished, it is gone. I mean, it's gone. It ain't coming back. To some of those other points about how I think the question becomes on some of that design, should they be talking, speculating on whether there's going to be parties? No, that's not within the purview of design review. So are there, I think there's definitely some reform that can occur there, whether it is a specific timeline that is set in place. It's like, look, you can only have the same amount of time it might otherwise take to permit the project anyway. That's built in. Maybe there needs to be more reeling in of exactly what the boundaries of considerations are for those, and be real clear. I think the Landmarks Board actually does a good job in being very clear when they are taking public testimony and public hearing over a nomination or a designation, in having people stick to the, like, not bringing in some of those other issues around, oh, well, you could build this here, or, oh, the neighborhood is this, that it's actually sticking to the criteria. Apply the criteria to the designation. And again, you may not like a style. Brutalism, Sandeep, you hit on it. No, nobody likes brutalism, right? Don't hate me just because I'm brutal. And that was a whole saga with the nuclear reactor building right on the UW campus, which is another story. But that doesn't mean it wasn't a significant, yeah, era of architecture and representative of a certain design. There's Central Washington right now is, I think it's their psychology building that was done by a prominent mid-century architect whose name is escaping me at the moment, but it's a really wonderful example of brutalist architecture. And guess what? Everybody hates it. So, you know, how do you deal with that? How do you handle those? And sometimes it is left up to the community. That's why we have some of those in certain communities, why there's a lot of power at that level. Erica, maybe there's too much and there's ways to roll back. Weaponization happens, but I think it happens in a lot of arenas.
Question here, just as we're thinking of ugly buildings that might end up being, you know, kind of architectural, you know, architecturally unique or whatever. The King County Admin Building, Chris, do you know, is that landmark? I mean, that's often cited as, like, see, Seattle's ugliest downtown building, right?
For its use or for its architecture, Erica?
Yeah, you should file a landmark application for it.
I guarantee you there's been discussions about it. I guarantee you there's been discussions about what to do with this, because by all the criteria, Yeah, it's a landmark. Now, because it's a, I think there's an agreement between the county and the city that for county-owned buildings in Seattle, they're under the jurisdiction of King County's preservation program, I believe. So that wouldn't be, the city wouldn't be dealing with that one. It would be the county's program. But
it's under the purview of the county wacko activists and not the city wacko activists.
I mean, I think, you know, I personally, you know, to me, it is not a matter of aesthetics. There are a lot of buildings, you know, elsewhere in the world that are very ugly, that are historic, you know, in places that are older than Seattle. You know, there's a lot of great communist architecture that, you know, we may find very ugly and wouldn't want in our city, but, you know, but it is historic. I think the issue is some of the landmarks criteria are pretty squishy. I mean, there's words like outstanding, that I think, do get weaponized. I think it is very easy to argue that something is the outstanding work of a particular architect and then to argue that that architect is significant, you know, without really providing a lot of proof, just kind of saying, well, I find this outstanding and you find this outstanding. So it's an outstanding example. That's where I get worried. It's not about whether I personally like the way a building looks. Cause like I said, I mean, I actually do, I kind of do like the King County, admin building.
I sort of, I'll guiltily admit, I'm kind of with you. I sort of like it too. Like,
and I kind of like some brutalist architecture, but that's not the issue for me. The issue is just kind of weaponizing these squishy terms, in the hands of, you know, individual people who happen to be on the Landmarks Board who all have, you know, political views.
They're citizen commissions, right? Things are going to flow like anything else. You might have a commission that is moves one way and then moves another way because of its makeup and composition. You know, that's true of any commission that's out there. That's a kind of natural component of having the types of processes we have, because you have individual people on there. And that's going to hold true whether it's a design review board, whether it is a transportation commission, whether it is an open space commission, whatever that might be. And so does that mean you throw away the process entirely? I don't think you do. I don't think that's the outcome. I think, are there always ways to be tweaking or potentially revising? Yeah, maybe you look at that. I think coming back to the question, I think David, you might have posed earlier about were people surprised at the council and what they did. I think one of our biggest concerns around it was part of that process and the fact that the Seattle's Landmarks process, which requires the council to adopt the ordinance with controls and incentives that ultimately codifies the landmark, and which we waited, 16 years for with the Walgreens, with the C-First Bank. Our concern was for the council to be, in some ways, Erica, doing what you're talking about. I remember a lot of the comments, I think, especially Councilmember Mosqueda saying, look, I just don't think this building's a landmark. I don't think it meets those standards. There's a subjective assessment on that side as well. So if that's the case, go back to the criteria, go back to the process, to the ordinance, and look at it from that standpoint. But don't kind of do what I think would be bad policy of just deciding after it's gone through a litany of stages, just deciding, I don't like this building. I don't think it should be there. I don't think it meets the criteria because of a subjective thing. So that would be the way to do it. And maybe that was what Councilmember Nelson, I know you wrote about her sort of flip-flopping from the committee responses to her final vote on the amendment. I think she spoke a little bit to, I was trying to read between the lines with her comments, and my interpretation was, maybe we need to go back and just look at this overall. That, I think, sure, if that's what the council wants to do, that's their prerogative. I think it was bad policy to just sort of subjectively make statements about that building after it had been vetted through a process that's been in place since the 70s.
Well, let's give our guest Chris Moore the last word on this edition of Seattle Nice with Erica C. Barnett and Sandeep Kaushik. I'm David Hyde. Thanks, everybody, so much for listening. If you're enjoying this podcast, we've made it to season 2. We'd like it to be sustainable, but that's not a guarantee. If you'd like to keep it going, if you'd like to help it continue, check out our Patreon page at Seattle Nice at Patreon. You can also advertise on this podcast by contacting us at Twitter, where you can also reach us to make comments, to make show suggestions. Our direct messages are open. And if you like the show, please give us a review wherever you're getting your podcast. Share this podcast with other folks. We're really trying to ramp it up heading into this election season here in the city of Seattle. So stay tuned. We've got some exciting stuff coming this year, but we can only do it with your support.